nation, with Jacinda Ardern of New Zealand fully supporting the Muslim community, whilst President Emmanuel Macron in France labelled the act of publishing cartoons as free speech. So with the world so openly exposed to such hatred through a variety of mediums, how then can the problem be addressed?
In regards to this question, it's very clear that for many, many years, the media has been exploiting, the way to criticize Muslims, by labeling them, for instance, as Islamists or terrorists, that they are a threat to, for instance, the Western governments and the social lifestyle here inside the West. And this has become now a normality. People listen to it all the time in media. This Islamists, these Muslims, these people are coming from war-torn countries, and they're trying to impose their Sharia laws, for instance. I mean, this continues on in all the media all the time. And nobody holds them accountable for using such labels on people.
One of the main methods for fighting such acts is to lead from the top. Therefore, the example of how to embrace integration, equality, and anti-racist sentiments should be demonstrated to the public by world leaders. Yet with the likes of Macron, Trump, and many others both publicly and privately glued to their discriminatory views, there has to be a change at the top before the idea finally trickles down to the masses.
IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Residents living on this quiet street, half an hour outside Paris, are intrigued. All eyes are riveted on one house, number 11. With the utmost discretion, behind closed shutters, two men meet face to face. Henry Kissinger, National Security Advisor to President Nixon, and Lê Duc Tho, Special Advisor to President Ho Chi Minh. From 1970 to 1973, far from Vietnam, the two men held secret negotiations in Choisy-le-Roi, Gives-sur-Yvette, and Saint-Nom-la-Bretèche in the suburbs of Paris. Still today, nobody is aware that hundreds of hours of their exchanges were recorded.
I thought yesterday we had reduced the issues on the text to only two. Now I find that there are 17. These substantive changes present the gravest difficulties for us in terms of good faith.
The two men are worlds apart, their culture, their ideology, their lives. They're at war. How will they make peace? A A war that has lasted for over 10 years, led by the world's leading power against a small country populated mostly by poor farmers. In the face of U.S. relentlessness, Vietnam is putting up a determined resistance. Incapable of winning the war, each side wants to force its opponent to negotiate peace to its advantage. Any headway made in the negotiations is hindered by the pro-American regime of South Vietnam, which is struggling in the face of robust political and military opposition, but also by upcoming elections in the U.S., and more generally, by the fragile balance of East-West relations in the middle of the Cold War. The fate of an entire population hinges on these negotiations. Two years before the first meeting between Lê Duc Tho and Henry Kissinger, a new political force had started weighing in on the war, U.S. public opinion. But not solely U.S. public opinion, the whole world was demanding peace and the withdrawal of U.S. troops from Vietnam. By the end of March 1968, the military situation had deteriorated. The U.S. Army was in difficulty, and President Johnson decided to negotiate with North Vietnam. 2 months later, talks, which had begun in Paris between the North Vietnamese minister, Xuân Thủy, and the U.S. Ambassador Averell Harriman, rapidly proved inefficient. It took them 8 months just to decide who should sit around the negotiating table. Because in Vietnam, in the field, four armed forces are clashing with each other, split into two camps. North Vietnam, with its capital Hanoi, is a communist state run by Ho Chi Minh. The father of the struggle for independence in Vietnam, he had a separation imposed on his country, splitting the country in two as part of the 1954 Geneva Accords in the form of a demarcation line along the 17th parallel. Hanoi supports the opposition in South Vietnam. In the south, the anti-communist regime of Saigon is heavily supported by the U.S. Army. For the U.S., which claims to be the world's sheriff, the challenge is to contain the rise of communism, stopping it on the 17th parallel. Since Mao Zedong's arrival to power in China, followed by North Korea, then North Vietnam, the Americans fear a domino effect. What is the issue for Hanoi?
What we demand for is what Ho Chi Minh demand for. We demand for independence and freedom, and American withdrew, and Saigon regime must leave. And the Saigon regime want to insist it that they are a nation. But Ho Chi Minh, no, we are one nation, one people.
By late 1968, during the official negotiations at Avenue Kléber in Paris, this strategy of containment has already proved very costly for the U.S. Demoralized GIs no longer believe in military victory over such a highly elusive enemy. From now on, for Washington, the objective is to get its troops out of the quagmire with its head held high. The other force around the negotiating table is the Saigon administration. At its head, General Nguyen Van Thieu, totally dependent on U.S. support. Thieu is concerned that the U.S. might abandon them on the altar of peace. He sets about attempting to sabotage the negotiations, and for the Americans, becomes a cumbersome partner.
We, South Vietnamese, did not want to oppose the talks, as we would have been accused of working against peace. But we told the Americans, who were starting talks with the North Vietnamese, that the future of Vietnam depended on the Vietnamese, not the Americans.
The final piece on the chessboard is the Fourth Military Force, the NLF, the National Front for the Liberation of South Vietnam. Nicknamed the Viet Cong by its opponents, it has formed its own political branch, the PRG, the Provisional Revolutionary Government, which is represented in Paris by Madame Nguyen Thi Binh. A resistant from the outset and a former political prisoner in Saigon, She is the voice of the armed resistance that controls part of South Vietnam and shares Hanoi's objectives to oblige the U.S. to leave Vietnam and to topple the Thieu regime.
We wanted what we called fighting while negotiating, a form of tactic. We had to fight on the three fronts, the military and political fronts, but also on the diplomatic front to try to strengthen our struggle.
As each party stands their ground, negotiations collapse.
Journalists refer to them as discussions among the deaf because of the way each party declared their position, which was then followed by a short exchange of criticism, and that was that. For 3 whole years, it was practically the same thing.
The new American president, Richard Nixon, then offered secret negotiations to Hanoi. On August 5, 1969, Henry Kissinger, Nixon's security advisor, and Xuân Thủy, a North Vietnamese minister, met in an apartment on the Rue de Rivoli in Paris. They were greeted there by Jean Saint-Denis, the former French delegate general in Hanoi. Secrecy, the cornerstone of the negotiations. For these diplomats of the shadows, secrecy gave them room to maneuver, to threaten, to bargain with, and to outwit their opponents, as well as to anticipate political and military issues. The closed doors loosened their tongues, as they were free from having to report to cumbersome partners. For as long as secrecy reigned, what was negotiated involved only themselves. Henry Kissinger and Le Duc Tho are skilled diplomats, well-versed in the art of playing chess against a racing clock. Kissinger knows that Le Duc Tho has fought the French and has been tortured at the prison of Pulo Condor, and that he has a top-level position in the Vietnamese Communist Party leadership. But he does not know that he has in front of him a member of the resistance, one of the leaders of the Liberation Army, who has just left the South Vietnam combat zone. As for Le Duc Tho, he is aware of Kissinger's past, his escape from Nazi Germany in the 1930s, his closeness to Nixon, his profile as an intellectual, a lecturer at Harvard, and a public figure accustomed to the bright lights of high society. But a major event delays the first meeting between Kissinger and Le Duc Tho. On September 2, 1969, in Hanoi, Ho Chi Minh passes away. At his bedside are Le Duc Tho and the other leaders of the country. In the middle of the war, a national state funeral is organized. Washington wonders whether the death of the emblematic leader might not influence the morale of troops. During the period of mourning, an entire people echo what Ho Chi Minh had proclaimed: Americans will never, never gain victory over us. On February 21, 1970, the first secret session between Le Duc Tho and Henry Kissinger takes place. The Vietnamese delegation is hosting, in a house it has hired, far from Avenue Kléber in Paris, at 11 Rue d'Arte in Choisy-le-Roi. The session is scheduled to start at 9:30 a.m. Precautionary and meticulous, Le Duc Tho arrives early. Self-confident, Henry Kissinger and his four colleagues arrive on time.
It was the first time that Le Duc Tho and Kissinger met. They shook hands and then exchanged a few words of courtesy, according to protocol.
10 people sit around a large rectangular table, including the interpreters. The two delegations find themselves face to face. The shutters are closed. There is a subdued atmosphere, far removed from the chaos of war. The two men weigh each other up.
During the secret meetings, we discussed issues. The term Henry Kissinger used was substantial issues.
The first meeting lasts nearly 6 hours. It is 9:40 a.m. as the countdown of the secret negotiation begins. Le Docteau says he does not trust American loyalty. You speak of peace, but you are waging war. We are wary because we have often been deceived. In 1945, we signed an agreement with the French, but they sent us troops. 9 years later, we reached an agreement in Geneva, which was torn up almost as soon as it was signed. So I am now wondering if your goodwill is sincere. I suggest you speak to us frankly. During this decade of war, you have spent a lot of money, gaining nothing in exchange. I do not understand. What interest do you have in continuing this war? When summing up to Nixon, Kissinger allowed himself a hint of optimism. On the major points, Mr. President, we totally disagree. But this first meeting remains positive. After lunch, taken separately, discussions resume. Le Docteau brings up several points at length.
The withdrawal of the American troops from South Vietnam was followed by the issue of the Saigon administration. Then the question of North Vietnamese troops stationed in South Vietnam came up, and then the issue of the demilitarized zone.
Kissinger fixes a priority for their following encounter. Our first objective is to reach a reciprocal agreement. We will withdraw our soldiers from South Vietnam, and you repatriate yours to North Vietnam, along with your troops currently present in Cambodia and Laos. The two men meet again in March and April 1970. For Le Docteau, sending American troops into Vietnam is clearly illegal. Kissinger replies that the presence of the North Vietnamese army in the South is also illegal, and he lays down a condition. I'll withdraw my troops only if you withdraw yours, Mr. Special Advisor. Le Docteau does not give way. He repeatedly states, Mr. Security Advisor, we are on home ground. This is an issue between the Vietnamese. The aggressor is you. Barely a month later, a new American attack puts an end to the talks between the two men. On April 29, 1970, a massive B-52 bombing campaign is carried out on East Cambodia, along the border with Vietnam. A similar campaign is carried out a few months later in Laos. The objective is to destroy the headquarters of the North Vietnamese High Command and that of the NLF, and to cut off the Ho Chi Minh Trail. A Ho Chi Minh Trail that has by now become a network of several thousand kilometers, a lifeline between the North and the South, along which transit provisions, military equipment, and troops, a network of tracks that the Americans have been bombing for 10 years in vain. The intervention in Cambodia causes major protest demonstrations, which are violently repressed by the National Guard. On Kent State campus, 4 students are killed.
I think except for the peace movement, there'd have been no peace talks in Paris. The anti-war movement reached a new high in 1968 with the March on the Pentagon, which was massive, tens of thousands, over 50,000 probably people moving toward the Pentagon, where the offices of all the military services. It had a huge impact on the country because they could see that, that there was real power, that there were masses behind, tens of thousands that were out there protesting. People wanted peace. They wanted an end to the killing in Vietnam.
Aware of the power of the peace movement, Nixon starts his mandate in 1969 with a program for U.S. Army withdrawal.
I have decided to reduce the authorized troop ceiling in Vietnam to 484,000 by December 15.
Blocking the route to communism is no longer the priority of the moment, given that the U.S. has lost a large part of its credit and prestige in the world. Richard Nixon wants to pull out of Vietnam, but has to do so with honor and without humiliation in order to restore U.S. splendor. An initial withdrawal of 50,000 men out of a total of 536,000. a pace at which Vietnam is not about to find peace. South Vietnamese soldiers have to take over from the Americans. The objective is to recruit, equip, and train 400,000 men over 3 years, creating the greatest military force in Southeast Asia entirely from scratch. Over a year goes by before Henry Kissinger and Lê Duc Tho meet again in July 1971. Is peace, so long awaited, getting nearer? Or are they buying time? Their strategy has not changed. Hanoi demands total withdrawal of U.S. troops, and Washington stalls by gradually withdrawing its soldiers while the ranks of the Saigon Army are being reinforced. Time for Hanoi and the NLF to catch their breath after months of combat? Probably.
The talks in Paris between Kissinger and Tho continued because the North Vietnamese were used to what we call in Vietnamese talks and military offensive at the same time.
We argued over territory, you could say. They were also very difficult years for us at the end of 69, 70, even 71, because the U.S. weapons were deadly, too.
For 10 years, until 1971, tens of thousands of tons of highly toxic chemicals, including the dioxin containing Agent Orange, are poured onto South Vietnam. The code name is Ranch Hand. The aim is to destroy the vegetation in order to kill the enemy hiding in it. But the victims are also civilians, men, women, and children. Science at the service of the unspeakable. A methodical and systematic spreading technique. The longest chemical war the world has known. An ecocide. Still today, the dioxin causes death and disability. In Paris, negotiations collapse and the prospect of peace recedes. No meetings take place between autumn 1971 and the beginning of 1972. Nixon travels to Peking in the first visit by an American head of state under the Mao regime. He then travels to Moscow. East-West relations are warming up. It is a historical moment for world balance and peace. It is the opportunity for Nixon and Kissinger to ask the Chinese and Soviets to reduce the military aid they give to their North Vietnamese ally and to put pressure on them. Tell them to make concessions. They are not heard.
We received heavy weaponry from the Soviet Union, and then light weaponry, and especially logistical assistance from China. But we use the weaponry to carry out our own war. Not with the presence or the participation of foreign soldiers on our land. In Vietnam, it was a war of liberation and not an international or a world war.
Over the space of 2 years, Lê Duc Tho and Henry Kissinger meet 10 times, always in secret. Can these face-to-face meetings really put an end to the conflict? Confronting their arguments obliges the men to draw up a peace plan. They have learned to weigh each other up, to pick up on their opponent's strengths and weaknesses, to grasp the way each of them work, and to test their intelligence.
I think Kissinger is a highly intelligent man, He has a great deal of humor and a lot of experience in negotiating. But he's a man of maneuvers, and he's imperturbable.
I have developed great respect for Lee Duck Tho. He was the representative of a relatively small country, negotiating with a superpower. His strategy was to break our spirit and give us no hope of a settlement except to yield to their terms. He did it with great discipline, great dignity, great politeness, and great mastery of the subject. So it was our bad luck that he was our adversary. He appeared as the representative of a communist power devoted to Marxist ideology, and he had the American peace movement on his side, so he thought he had time. We had to try to out-endure him.
Lê Đức Tho fought too, in a very courageous but also intelligent way. That's why we say that Mr. Kissinger, who is highly confident and perhaps just a little vain, he still had to. And I'm not sure if I'm using the right term here, but he had to bend down in front of the Đức Tho.
In the limelight. 56% of Brazil's 211 million citizens identify as black or brown. But last year, nearly 80% of those killed by police officers and 75% of murder victims were black. One of the most recent victims was João Alberto Silveira Freitas, a 40-year-old father of four, who was beaten to death by security guards outside a Carrefour supermarket in Porto Alegre on the eve of Brazil's Black Awareness Day. That horrific attack, which was caught on camera, sparked street protests in several major Brazilian cities and was compared to the killing of George Floyd in the United States. Flavio Oliveira, a prominent black broadcaster, called such killings part of the toxic legacy of slavery in a country that was the last Western nation to abolish the practice in May of 1888. Brazil's failure to offer education, land, or compensation to hundreds of thousands of newly emancipated slaves meant that more than 130 years later, profound inequalities persisted, with black Brazilians earning less, living worse, and being killed more often than their white counterparts. We now present you an article written by Tom Phillips under the heading, Killing of Two Girls Stokes Outrage Over Brazil's Horrific Toll of Black Lives. The article has been taken from the British newspaper The Guardian. Please stay with us for more of Tom Phillips's article. shooting of two young black girls who had between them enjoyed fewer than 11 years of life has sparked outrage in Brazil and intensified the debate over police violence and structural racism in a country still grappling with the legacy of slavery. Emily Victoria Moreira dos Santos and Rebecca Beatriz Rodriguez Santos, cousins, aged 4 and 7, were killed on Friday night, 4th of December, as they played outside their grandmother's home in Barro Vermelho, a red brick favela on Rio de Janeiro's rundown northern fringe. Their deaths took the number of children killed in Rio de Janeiro this year to 8, nearly all of them black, like most Brazilian murder victims. Emily's mother, Ana Lucia Silva Moreira, who believes police were responsible for the shooting, vowed, "I feel crushed, but I'm going to find the strength to fight for Emily, for Rebecca, and for all the other girls, because black lives matter." She added, "I wasn't raising my daughter so she could become part of a statistic." Witnesses claimed they had seen a police officer shoot into the community at about 8:30 p.m. local time that night, although Rio's military police had denied its agents opened fire. As the victim's uncle, André da Silva Moreira, and his sister relived the crime on Monday morning, 7th of December, in a plaza near their home in the city of Duque de Caxias, they said, "It's because they're cowards." Ana Lucia, a 38-year-old street hawker, cut in, "And because we're black too." André asked, "You know what rights we have in this country," adding, "The right to become a slab of meat in the hands of our governors." Shootings, part of a remorseless wave of infant deaths in a city awash with high-caliber rifles, sparked an immediate outcry. Former Brazilian President Dilma Rousseff slammed the veritable carnage being unleashed in Rio de Janeiro's poorest communities by the police's utter lack of control. The black philosopher, Jamila Ribeiro, declared, "This is a genocidal country." One of the most moving protests came from Thiago Amparo, a black public intellectual. He wrote in the Folha de São Paulo, "There comes a point where tears can no longer express our pain, demanding who will answer for the genocide that is underway." On Sunday, 6th of December, scores of mourners and activists gathered in Duque de Caxias, carrying dolls smothered with fake blood and banners reading, "Stop killing us," and "Vidas Negras Importam," Black Lives Matter. Rio de Janeiro's acting governor, Claudio Castro, promised a rigorous inquiry into the deaths and said he favored a security policy that was based on intelligence and sought to protect lives. Cecilia Oliveira, a public security specialist and journalist, said the killings captured perfectly the futility and racial bias of Brazil's unceasing war on drugs, which claims thousands of mostly black lives each year. Oliveira said, "What happened to those two children in a predominantly black and poor neighborhood far from the center of Rio de Janeiro is the synthesis of what Brazil chose as its public security policy, the extermination of invisible and quote-unquote undesirable people." Official statistics made clear the bloodshed's racial skew. 56% of Brazil's 211 million citizens identify as black or brown. But last year, nearly 80% of those killed by police officers and 75% of murder victims were black. One of the most recent victims was João Alberto Silveira Freitas, a 40-year-old father of four who was beaten to death. death by security guards outside a Carrefour supermarket in Porto Alegre on the eve of Brazil's Black Awareness Day. That horrific attack, which was caught on camera, sparked street protests in several major Brazilian cities and was compared to the killing of George Floyd in Minneapolis, Minnesota, in the United States. Flavia Oliveira, a prominent black broadcaster, called such killings part of the toxic legacy of slavery in a country that was the last Western nation to abolish the practice in May of 1888. Brazil's failure to offer education, land, or compensation to hundreds of thousands of newly emancipated slaves meant that more than 130 years later, profound inequalities persisted, with black Brazilians earning less, living worse, and being killed more often than their white counterparts. Oliveira said Brazil remains a country that is built on the privileges of white people. Oliveira, the security specialist, said she had no doubt about the racial dimension of the slaying of João Alberto, Emily, and Rebecca. Spurning recent claims from the country's vice president, Hamilton Mourão, that racism did not exist, Oliveira said, "What these cases tell us in such brazen, crystal-clear terms is that black lives do not matter in Brazil." Relatives of Emily and Rebecca also scoffed at Vice President Hamilton Mourão's remarks as they gathered to demand justice for the girls who were shot in the head and chest and whose final moments are too horrifying to describe. Recalling how she had bought Emily a beautiful toy for the party they had planned, Ana Lucia Silva Moreira said of her daughter, "She was going to turn 5 years old on 23rd of December. Instead, she was buried in it on Saturday afternoon, 5th of December, in a tatty concrete grave." Rebecca's grandmother, Lydia da Silva Moreira Santos, said she had just returned home from a 12-hour shift at the hospital, where she cleans a COVID-19 ward. When she heard gunfire, she was adamant came from police. The 51-year-old said, "She was my only granddaughter, my flesh and blood, and they took her from me in the most ridiculous, cruel, and brutish way possible. They didn't have the right to do that," adding, "It's insane, just insane." The two girls smiled out from Santos's white t-shirt, printed in memory of youngsters she considered her princesses. The tribute below read, "Emily and Rebecca, words cannot express the sadness I feel right now."
This is IRIB English Radio.
IRIB English Radio. With you every single moment.
From the very heart of evergreen forests, under the starry sky of the desert, with the radiance of silver-colored sand, in the midst of proud mountains, closer, Iran.
Hello, I am Mitra, an Iranian nature traveler. To know more about the wonders and beauties of magnificent Iran, keep me company. Plenty of spectacular sights and things in the azure waters of the Persian Gulf. One of these must-see places is the historical Loft Port. The beauties of this port village are many. Today, I've made a trip to Esh in order to visit the Loft Village and see its beauties from a closer view. Loft is one of the villages of Qeshm in Hormozgan province, located in southern Iran. Loft Port is situated in northwest of Qeshm Island. Residents of Loft made trips across the ocean by sailing boats and traded with African countries as well as India since not very long time ago. Loft is one of the very hot and humid regions of Iran. The most important professions of the residents of this village include lunch building, lunch maintenance, and fishing. In addition to natural beauties, this village has placed really precious heritages, including Naderi Castle, the Portuguese castle, Tala Wells, as well as a historical cemetery, which has inscriptions dating back to 1,000 years ago. I am now standing by one of the beautiful mosques of Loft Village. This mosque is white in color, and its presence in the blue context of the sky looks very magnificent. Well, there are 7 mosques in Loft, and residential districts are made around these mosques. These mosques, besides being places of worship, are also places for cultural and social congregations of the villagers. Well, let's see what's going on in the residential areas. My God, what beautiful houses! The houses of this village have all central yards and wind catchers. The wind catchers are made in different sizes and have transformed the Loft Village into the port of wind catchers. The architecture of these houses remind me of the city of Yazd. I am now beside the Tala Wells in Loft. I have never seen such a bizarre thing like this. The bottom part of these wells have plaster layers, which make it possible for the water to stay quite cool and healthy for a longer period of time. The surface waters of the village, which have been collected by the sudden rains, flow to the Tala Wells and the main cistern of the village. One of the local people told me that the number of these wells is 366, which represent the number of days in a leap year, and that people used one well for each day. Well, to be honest, there are a lot of wells here, and I can't count them all. I am now by the shore. The beautiful launches of loft residents are floating. Fishermen are busy catching fish. And the lovely sound of seagulls have doubled the beauty of Loft Village. I'm going to come back here in the evening so that I could have the opportunity to enjoy the beautiful moments of sunset. Until next time, goodbye.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. What you heard was an IRIB English radio program.
Round the World with Reporters.
After the controversial law on global security and the massive protest against it, the French government has approved another controversial bill, this time called Law on Separatism, provoking again a popular protest. Prime Minister Castex openly said that this bill targets what he called radical Islam, enemy of the Republic. President Emmanuel Macron has promoted the bill to target separatists undermining the nation.
I have the impression that Islamophobia is an important electoral trading issue. I don't think that Marine Le Pen will win the elections, but to prevent that, the actual government is playing on the ground of the far right.
A rarely seen police cordon surrounded the demonstration entirely from the beginning till the end. Every 100 meters, the police charged the demonstration and made arrests. Some were wounded. Macron had said that the presumed radical black bloc has to be destroyed. Therefore, the police had clear orders, zero tolerance. However, this time, the violence did not come from the demonstrators. Human rights groups have raised concerns over the law, saying it would discriminate and stigmatize French Muslims.
There's so much ambiguity in the formulation of the bill that anyone can be accused of anything anytime. The head of police can't dissolve any association on any grounds. With this law, justice does not exist anymore. The democratic state does not exist anymore. Anyone who is a bit annoyed by Muslims can use this law in an arbitrary way. It has to be abolished, same as the law on global security.
The bill in question requires that everyone strictly respects the French Republican principles of secularism, whatever that might mean. The funding of Muslim associations and mosques will be closely monitored. The main association in defense of Muslims, the CCIF, was dissolved. All organizations will have to sign a declaration on secularism if they want to receive funds from the state. In case of non-compliance, they would have to refund the money. The new bill will be discussed in the French Parliament. Members of the majority party already declared that they want to modify the text. Some want to soften it, others want to make it even more restrictive. Chris Den Hand, Paris.
In a move lauded by Austria's Muslim community, the National Constitutional Court has officially lifted the ban on headscarves at elementary schools. The controversial ban, approved last year by the previous conservative right-wing coalition government, has now been ruled unconstitutional. The court's president says it singles out the religion of Islam unjustifiably, goes against the religious and ideological neutrality of the state, and violates the principle of equality.
The selective ban could have an adverse effect on the inclusion of students and lead to discrimination. It excludes Islamic origin and tradition and carries the risk of making it difficult for Muslim girls to access education and could marginalize them from society.
Austria's Islamic faith community, which had filed a complaint about the ban in January, welcomed the ruling, saying it would end a populist prohibition policy.
We are against constraints and prohibitions because, as it is said in the Holy Quran, there is no compulsion in the matter of faith. Our trust in the rule of law and our patience have paid off.
The ban prevented girls up to the age of 10 from wearing headscarves in school.
I think this is a big step forward because schoolgirls are often discriminated because of their hijab, and with this new rule, they should be able to live it out freely and without any discrimination, even if it's by other school students or teachers. So I think it's kind of a part of a revolution.
While the opposition Social Democrats, the Liberals and the Greens all welcomed the decision, members of the Conservative ruling party called it regrettable, and the right-wing Freedom Party even suggested attempts to reinstate it. The ban's proponents argued they were protecting young girls from being pressured into observing the hijab.
But Muslim families deny this allegation, saying using force against girls who choose to wear the headscarf undermines efforts to give them equal opportunities and self-determination. And this time, they've won the argument. Homa Rezgi, Vienna.
Meeting top Afghan officials to finalize the joint comprehensive strategic document between Iran and Afghanistan was the major reason behind the visit of Iranian Deputy Foreign Minister Sayed Abbas Araghchi to the Afghan capital Kabul. Analysts say the move will further boost the ties between Iran and Afghanistan.
The visit of Iran's deputy foreign minister to Kabul was fruitful for both sides. Both sides have agreed to finalize the joint comprehensive and strategic document between Iran and Afghanistan. This is a win-win deal, helping Kabul and Tehran boost their ties.
In an exclusive interview with Press TV, the Iranian official stressed the importance of expansion of ties between Kabul and Tehran through numerous ways, including increase of strategic partnership in different fields. He also stressed that bringing peace and political stability to Afghanistan under an Afghan-owned process is one of priorities of Tehran's regional policy.
We would remain backing Iraqi Afghan government and people in their fight for their for peace and stability and prosperity. We do consider peace and security in Afghanistan as our own peace and security, and we do consider the prosperity of Afghan people as the prosperity of Iranians. So we are certainly after a good, constructive, mutually beneficial relations with Afghanistan.
The visit of Iran's deputy foreign minister to Kabul comes as both countries, Iran and Afghanistan, have recently inaugurated the first joint railway project connecting western Afghanistan to eastern Iran as a proof of growing cooperation between both countries. Mutual ties between Kabul and Tehran are expanding as both sides are fighting U.S.-sponsored terrorism and sanctions. But the two countries, observers say, have proved that they will never set back against enemies. Sayed Amin Alemi, Kabul.
Senior officials have told us, in the eyes of EU leaders, Donald Trump's credibility is now non-existent because of his refusal to concede the US presidential election. At their two-day summit in Brussels, which concluded on Friday, they adopted conclusions designed to reset relations with Washington.
We would like to further develop our partnership with the US in various sectors in the future. We want to stress the importance of multilateral cooperation on the international agenda. This is at the very core of the EU.
Critics say EU leaders lost a great deal of credibility themselves during the past 4 years over their failure to stand up to Trump.
For example, what did they do when Trump tried to start trade wars? Took the US out of the Paris Climate Agreement, withdrew funding for Palestinian refugees and supported Israel's illegal occupation program. And what about his rubbishing of the World Health Organization amid a global pandemic?
Political scientists claim the weakness of EU leaders to challenge Trump makes them complicit. Arguably, the bloc's greatest foreign policy achievement, the Iran nuclear deal, was left to flounder as Trump did everything to try and destroy it at the behest of Israel, critics argue. If Joe Biden can save the accord agreed by world powers in 2015, there would be many plus sides, experts say.
I hope we can switch as soon as possible on the question of security through prosperity on Middle East. And this is, I feel, the dream of all the Middle East people.
The EU continues to express optimism about the Joe Biden administration, which is due to take office next month.
We hope that this is going to be a more positive one. It has been a bumpy road in the last years, and there is a lot of hope on the working between the European Union and the US.
Many analysts warn if EU leaders don't get tougher, populism will continue to flourish in the West, and they might be seeing Trump back in the White House in 4 years' time. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
A typical day in the life of mother of four, Naomi Rantry, founder and CEO of Educare Family Support Service, a fundraiser in West London that uses public donations to help children and families during the pandemic.
We started this food parcel delivery in May. So we did that for about 13 weeks. The numbers were just increasing. We started on 7 on our first week, and it ended up being 200 every week.
First stop, a school. Earlier this year, the British government had to reverse its decision not to offer free school meals in the Christmas holidays, following a campaign by football star Marcus Rashford. Still, more help is needed.
If there's an issue financially, we could support them with maybe some debt management, some financial assistance. In other areas, it might be school uniform they need support with.
People who use food banks are generally double-income, low-wage earners. In struggling families, all it takes is for one parent to lose their job. Karina used to work in the tourism sector in central London.
I used to work part-time on a zero-hours contract, and it was like a normal life for me. Now I'm on a minus because I've stopped working. I had to ask for help. I never knew about food bank. I just found out since I was on a financial difficulty.
Living in a nondescript apartment in West London, Karina, whose husband does food deliveries, not only has to care for her three-year-old daughter, but also her ailing father, who lives alone.
Everything starts to go really bad with him. Sorry, I'm crying. And because I'm the one who's obliged, you know, to help him, to look after him, because he's my only parent.
The Trussell Trust that runs 1,200 of the UK's 2,000 food banks say they gave out more than 1 million emergency food packages between April and September. Nearly 500,000 went to children. They also warn these figures are the tip of the iceberg.
Nearly 2 million people have used a food bank in the UK in the past year, almost 300,000 more than the year before. While the government has taken steps, charities say they're not enough, which is why they're relying on donations from the public to try and tackle hunger in the world's sixth largest economy.
In the absence of an income, many adults living with children in this country have reported skipping meals in the last 8 months. It's the last month of the year, and the nation of nearly 67 million is gearing up for Christmas. Without adequate government support and with food banks under strain, poverty may well rear its ugly head in more British homes. Saeed Pureza, London.
Give us a decent housing, requisition of empty buildings. That's what the protesters demand from the French government. With the support of human rights associations, these homeless or poorly housed people have made a list of huge empty buildings in the Paris area. They handed over this list to the police headquarters and required that the housing law be applied.
We can apply this law to house everyone, even the precarious homeless French. Thanks to this law, everyone can have a roof above his head. If every